You're listening to the Sports Therapy Association podcast. Let's talk about.
Welcome to Sports Therapy Association podcast, episode 36. I hope you're well. Thanks for joining us. If you're watching on YouTube, we are available there live if you don't want to go to Facebook. Or you obviously are welcome to join us on the Sports Therapy Association Facebook page where we are live as well. And indeed, people are flocking in now. And the advantage of coming to Facebook is you can, and also on YouTube, you can say your name, you can ask questions live. Little picture of you comes up. So, hi, Carolyn, how are you doing? If you're listening to the podcast, the recording, that's great as well. Thank you very much. But maybe you want to check out joining us live at some point as well. If it suits your time zone with GMT in the UK, so it might not suit you. Yeah, it is lovely to see you all coming along and sharing your questions with our guests. Hi, Mark, how are you doing? Chris is here as well. Oh, there's going to be a lot of people in tonight. I can tell already. Some of the names coming in. So, yeah, so like I say, we are live, but we're also a podcast on YouTube. If you are watching on YouTube, then do us a favor. If you enjoy the content, if you could subscribe. We've gone from zero a few months ago up to something like 250 million now. No, it's not quite. It's 250. But we're catching John Gibbons up. It's not far away. And also, like I say, we're a podcast. So if you prefer listening to the recording, you can catch us on any of the popular podcast players. Just type in Sports Therapy Association and we will come up and be there ready for you. And we're like on 36 episodes now. It's going to be today. It's gone flying by, one a week. And we're still going strong and hopefully providing you some support, particularly if you're in a country where there's a lockdown going on. Obviously, that's what's on most of our minds. So, yeah, do come along and join us. Thank you to last week, talking of lockdown and mental strain. Last week was a very popular episode with James Chapman, who was talking about mental health first aid training. It was a fantastic episode. It was real. Most of it was thanking James for opening up about his own demons and coming through it and now helping other people. But there were some great pearls of wisdom with regards to spotting triggers and clients who you may need to provide some extra support, whether that's actually referring them on to somebody who can help them or just asking the right questions. It drew a lot of parallels with the pelvic health episodes we did with Bill Taylor and Gráinne Donnelly, where a lot of therapists have said they're having to tweak their kind of Parkview questions, the medical questionnaire at the beginning. It used to be good enough to say, what's your stress levels like between 0 and 10? But now maybe we need to put a few more questions in there to divide it up a bit more, just to give our clients the chance to say yes or no to some more specific questions and open up the communication if they want. If you don't allow them to open the door, then we don't know and they won't present us with that chance. And it's so important to give that opportunity. And also James touched on how important it is for us as therapists to be aware of mental health and whether we should be reaching out and getting support from somebody. So anyway, it's a fantastic episode. And thanks again to James for giving up his time for that. And like I say, it's available as a podcast now on YouTube as well, if you prefer to watch it. So that's great. Thank you, James. And All About the Mind is his website. Definitely worth checking out there. All details of courses, if you're interested in mental health first aid training, are on there, delivered online. Definitely something to think about, particularly with the current goings on and on and on. Tonight, Dr. Tim Gabbett. I think this is probably out of our 36 episodes to date, had most of the reaction on social media ever, which I'm sure Tim will be smiling about. It was suggested that I should start recruiting teams for elite football teams or something. I don't understand about football, but the fact that we managed to get Dr. Gabbett on here tonight seemed to be very well praised and rejoiced. So you want somebody, we'll ask them. And it's all thanks to you guys, really. I mean, the podcast is going well. It's raising ears. And what we're talking about and the guests we're getting on is being congratulated on many levels. So it's all up to you guys for sharing it. And coming along live. So credit to you guys that we are able to get people of Dr. Gabbett's level and experience onto the show. So before I do bring up, there he is in action as well. Can't wait to ask about that photo. And those of you not aware of Dr. Gabbett, Tim Gabbett, the best stat, which I didn't realize when I was doing a little bit of research. I followed Tim for a long time because he's been around a long time. He's seen great things for a long time. But apparently in a recent study of 8 million scientists, that's 8 million scientists, in PLOS Biology, he was named in the top 25 most impactful sports scientists of all time. So there you go. That's the category and the of person we've got on the show tonight. Two PhDs, all about human physiology and applied sports science. A huge amount of published articles, over 250, all peer-reviewed, and internationally and nationally hugely respected. And we've got the joy of listening to and talking with Tim tonight about load management, which is something which I imagine a lot of people in here are aware of. I'm kind of hoping, as always, that if you are tuning in, particularly on the podcast, that maybe you've heard of the term. It's quite a buzzword. It's been going around for at least a year now in a more topical kind of people talking about it way. But as with everything that catches on quickly, misconceptions and red herrings, and a lot of that is going to be cleared up, I'm sure, by Dr. Tim Gabbett tonight. So without further ado, I should bring him up. Welcome, Dr. Tim Gabbett. There we go. We're live. Hey, mate, how you doing?
Great. Thanks, Matt. Hi, everyone. How are you all?
Oh, I forgot to say as well, it's like, what, 6 o'clock were you in the morning?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Beautiful time of day.
I'm sorry about that. I'm not going to lie, and I've got to give a shout. Whenever someone joins us really early, it wasn't for this, it's a Run Chat Live, but JF Esculio actually joined me, I think, from... where was he? In Canada. I can't remember where he was now, but at 4 o'clock in the morning. He just said, yeah, I can do it. That's fine, man. He was like 4 o'clock. But no, I appreciate it. And you're in Brisbane. On the plus side, I guess it's going to be a beautiful sunny day where you are, is it?
Oh, look, it's been raining for a day or two, so it might be wet today.
Oh, geez, didn't realise.
Yeah, we get a bit of rain in summer.
I was in Brisbane years ago, probably 90 or something years ago. I was there the year that they had the earthquake in where was it? What's the name of the place? Where was the big earthquake? It's gone. Newcastle. Yeah, I was there for the benefit gig. Got to see Johnny Diesel and the Injectors, all the guys. It was great. Great concert. Terrible natural disaster, but it was a great year to be in Australia.
Well, I'll tell you that growing up, that was Johnny Diesel and the Injectors were probably one of my favorite bands. And I went and saw them as a I think about a 15-year-old. I snuck into a nightclub. Actually, I didn't sneak in. My dad knew I was going, and just to make sure that I wasn't drinking, he came down to embarrass me while I was there, just to check on me. Oh, it was so embarrassing, but it was a good concert.
Yeah,
good gig.
Yeah, very, very nice. Yeah, great album. Anyway, so there we go. So thanks so much for joining us. People, you can see now the comments on the live. We've got like about 53 people in there so far, which is great for live. Hats off to all of you for joining us live. No one watches anything live these days, so it's amazing to have you guys along. If you have got questions, then feel free. I'll bring you up onto the screen. But I'm going to ask him some first, as always. So, Tim, Dr. Gabbett, what should you do? Tim.
Yeah, Tim's fine.
Good to check. So just for people who aren't aware of you, I mean, I know it's like 25 years or more of being in the industry, but briefly, how did it start and how do you get to where you are and who have you seen in the process along the way?
I'd been playing around in sport for a lot of time, and like most people, I'd done a lot of volunteer jobs and, you know, a lot of semi-elite type work in different sports. I think one of my first full-time jobs where I actually could live off what I was doing was in Tasmania. I moved from Queensland down to Tasmania. So it was our summer, moved down, and it was quite cold down there in Tasmania. And I was the head of sports science at the Institute of Sport. After I finished there, I moved back to Queensland and got a job with the Queensland Academy of Sport. And we have academies and institutes all in every state. And the academies and institutes do some wonderful work. They're the ones who put the majority of athletes on teams and probably make the greatest contribution to the medal tally. From there, and I worked with swimming for a lot of years, and worked with team sports in that environment for a lot of years, and from there I moved on to professional sports. So I'd been in high performance amateur sport. So they're the ones who train really hard, but have to work during the day, and they're the ones that go to the Olympics. But in professional sport, you're there full time. You can focus on one sport. So I moved into worked for the Brisbane Broncos for a number of years and a number of different rugby league clubs. And that was probably 10 years ago now. I finished there and I've sort of just been moving around to where life takes me from there.
And when was it? Was there a point where suddenly you started thinking, hold on, these athletes could be training a bit differently here. What's going on? Or the industry kind of like made you think we're missing a trick here with regards to load. Did that come at a point, or was it slowly over a few years?
Oh look, I guess it's been a slow burn. I'd come from a background of training really hard myself, and then we went through an era in the early 2000s, and this is, as an industry, I think, where there was a real trend towards trying to prevent injuries by managing players away from load. That I'd heard it so many times. We don't want you to break in training. We want you to get to game day. So we don't want you to overtrain. Where players would be encouraged to do their extras previously, they'd be taken off the rower, or they'd be taken out of training to stop them from overdoing it. And it didn't really sit comfortably with me at all. But there was some research to show that higher training loads were associated with injury. And it wasn't until I started to notice that some of our best players, the ones who were training the most regularly, were the ones who were staying injury free. That was something that was interesting to me. Just like it didn't marry up with what the textbook was telling us about training load and overuse injuries. And then I was seeing that a lot of our players who were in rehab were the ones who were getting injured the most, re-injured the most. And then it dawned on me that it wasn't training load that was the problem, or high loads that were the problem. It was the fact that it was how our athletes were getting to those high loads. When they were starting from a really low base and ramping up real quickly, that's was where we were seeing the problems. When we could actually get them to those high training loads, the high loads were protecting them against injury, and they were giving them the physical qualities that allowed them to perform. And the more I looked at it, the more and the different sports I work with, the data just kept showing the same thing, that when we could build safely to higher loads, it creates a robustness and it creates resilience.
So along the way, and I think a few people in here have probably come across now and read about it, this idea of acute and chronic workload ratio. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, essentially what we're talking about is the load that you've done over a long period of time, the training that you've done over a long period of time, and we refer to that as chronic load. And chronic load is analogous to your capacity. And acute load is the training load that you've performed over a much shorter period of time. And we need our acute load to be slightly greater than our capacity in order to improve our capacity. It's like any stress, you can run away from it or you can move towards it. The more often you move towards it, the more likely it is you're going to be able to cope with it. Now, the acute to chronic workload ratio is just a ratio that looks at the size of the acute load, what you've done in a recent period of time, relative to your capacity. If you have very small increases in acute load relative to your chronic load or your capacity, then you can safely build to higher chronic loads, which is a good thing. But most of us are aware, or all of us are aware, that if you throw excessive loads, excessive acute loads at your capacity to handle it. So it's much greater than your capacity to handle that load, then it increases the risk of whatever tissue you're prescribing that load to of breaking down.
It's I wonder if it's the same for people in here or people listening, but for me, as soon as the word chronic comes up, you have kind of like negative connotations. We always think of chronic as in like chronic disease. And even hearing you say it now, even though I've read it and appreciated it and said it myself, whenever you say kind of like chronic load, it makes it sound like it's something negative. Do you find that in courses you've been to, or is it just people who are, I don't know, is it, maybe it's something in the UK? I just find the word chronic difficult to associate with something. We need to kind of concentrate on chronic load.
Yeah, look, I can see how you would say that, and you know, let's put it into context as well that not all load is created equal. So we're talking in general terms that if you can, you know, chronic load in my way of looking at it is being able to train consistently, having a consistency about what you do. But in saying that, Not all load is good. So if we were to look at different tissue types, high chronic loads might be protective against something like muscle injuries, like muscle strains. But that same high chronic load that is protective against muscle injuries might actually come back and bite you in another tissue type. For example, joint injuries. If we see someone who's, you know, the way I could describe this, someone who's trained and played for a number of years and they've never seemed to get injured, they're protected against muscle injuries, but towards the back end of their career, maybe they start to pick up a few joint injuries. That's an example of how, you know, high chronic loads could actually be a negative thing in this context. You know, the other thing we don't know is it's good to have higher chronic loads. It helps you cope with the acute demands of the sport. But we don't know how long it's good to have those high chronic loads for, because a lot of the studies are never that long. You know, typically they're a year to a couple of years long in terms of how long you can maintain those high chronic loads for. We don't really know.
Mm-hmm. So how would you, I mean, if we've got people in here or listening to the podcast who are working with athletes and they're looking at kind of strength and conditioning programs. First of all, somebody who is trying to, I notice you never use the word prevent injury. Is that on purpose, or everything I read from you is reduce the risk of injury? Do you not like using the word prevent, or is it done on purpose?
Well, I think the first thing to keep in mind is that, I don't know for sure whether I've prevented an injury. Because it, you know, if it didn't happen, you don't know whether it would have happened, or it just, you know, it would have been prevented anyway, or would have, you know, not happened anyway. So injury prevention, it's kind of semantics, really. We can talk injury prevention, we can talk injury reduction, or we can talk greater availability, or, you know, I just prefer to say robustness and resilience. You know, that's I can't guarantee someone's not going to get injured, nor can I predict when someone is going to get injured. All I know is I have a lot of faith in my ability to develop physically and mentally resilient athletes. And that just comes from having a good training program, using well-established training principles, but also understanding the person that's in front of me. You know, understanding what makes them tick. I don't think I'd be a very good internet trainer or an internet coach. I don't think I would be able to do that because I feel like I need more information. The more information I have is just having that person in front of me, being able to communicate with them, give them a little squeeze on the arm occasionally, eyeball them to see, you know, to actually challenge them to get a bit more out of themselves. They're the kind of things that the numbers, you know, measuring numbers won't give me. It's the relationship with that person that helps me develop a good program for them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's quite healthy I was just interested whether you do it on purpose or not, because I think it's quite healthy not to use the word prevent, because it just accepts that we don't know what's causing injury. We just kind of do what we can and look at the person, like you say. It's not always going to be the same thing. But I've seen you kind of call out a little bit, kind of announcements and promises of we can prevent injury, kind of like 80, 90% or something. But you're not kind of a fan of that. And where do you sit? Like the other day, we were talking on this podcast about screening and things like that. I don't, from what I can gather, you're not a big fan of screening. I mean, even if you know about a chronic load and an acute load, is there a way of screening athletes to really, really kind of limit chances of injury?
Look, I wouldn't say that I'm not a fan of screening. In fact, I think there's a it's a place for screening. I think we've got to be careful how we use those results. So if we think we're going to use those screening results to predict injury, then we're probably a 50-50 chance that it's going to work. At best screening and a lot of training monitoring tools are not good at predicting injury. And there's a lot of studies now that using a wide range of statistical tools and non-linear tools, neural networks, none of them are particularly good at predicting injury from either training load data or from screening tools or a combination of both. But I wouldn't say that means we stop doing it. In fact, I think the screen is a perfect example of identifying either musculoskeletal limitations or physiological limitations. If we identify those, then what it allows us to do is put some individual work-ons or an individual program in place. You strengthen those physical qualities, which allows you or puts you in a better place to handle the physical demands of the game. And that's what we're training for. We're training for being able to perform the demands of the game. Training, and if we can perform the demands of the game, we're in a position for better performance. And as a byproduct of that, we may actually get tolerance or injury reduction. We may actually get protected against injury. That may be another positive side effect of it. But I don't think we should throw it out. Nor should I. I don't think we should be using it to try and predict injuries either.
Okay, great. Thank you. I've got a question here from Aaron. I'll bring it up. If you're listening to the podcast, you can't see it come on the screen. But Aaron Bryars here asks, I've read a lot about increasing training load and capacity. A lot of research talks about the weekly 10% increase in training load as a rule of thumb. How would you educate therapists to successfully rehabilitate from injured rather than injury free or more than injury free? Thanks, guys. Not sure what the last bit is there.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Look, the 10% rule is it's a guide. In general, what we want to try and do is avoid massive spikes in load, because out of any of the findings from research that are pretty consistent, it's that large increases in load, rapid increases in load increase your risk. Now you can use the 10% rule or 10% guide, but have a think about, you need to consider the capacity of your athlete. So if you have an athlete or patient, I'll use the word athlete, but I'm talking about athletes or patients. If you have an athlete in bed rest, then 10% might be too much, because they just have no capacity to handle load. If you have someone who is in early stage rehab, then you might be able to increase more than 10%, because 10% of nothing is still nothing. Now, equally at the other end of the spectrum, if you have an elite level athlete who you're either trying to rehabilitate or if they're trying to improve their own capacity, it'll be impossible to add 10% on top of that, because they're so close to the ceiling, their glass is almost completely full. So the increase in load might be 0.1%. And this is where, firstly, that the 10% rule is really only a guide, because you have to consider the capacity of your athlete. And the second part is, this is where the acute chronic workload ratio comes in, because what it does is it takes into account the loading of your athlete relative to their capacity to handle load. We're talking about acute increase in load relative to their chronic load or their capacity to handle it.
Okay. Aaron, if you want to follow up on that, then feel free to. Just write another comment in there. Great to come back to that. Caroline McKendrick says, in my level 5 sports massage course in 2019, the lecturer told us that slow increased load was good generally for rehab purposes, but the risk of injury or re-injury was higher on chronic tendinopathy. It was advised to load high to prevent re-injury.
Without knowing too many specifics of that lecture, I think in general, we have to be cautious of someone in rehab, because whenever you get an injury, you're going to have reductions in local tissue capacity, which are probably driven by pain, it won't happen immediately, but not long after local tissue falls, sports specific capacity will probably fall to the basement as well. So if you've got those two capacities that have dropped, you need to consider how you're going to bring them back up. So let's talk about local tissue capacity first. You know, the first thing I think that needs to be done is you need to calm the tissue down. You need time for biological healing. The trick then is to be able to restore local tissue capacity and restore sport-specific capacity before you can bridge the gap between where they are in rehab and where they need to be in peak performance. Now, in the early stages, you probably need to take it a little bit slower, but I would use the word assertive is probably the best way to describe it. Don't be fearful of load. You can be respectful of it, but just don't be fearful of it. Don't wrap your athlete up in cotton wool, because if you can load and load early with a lot of injuries, and particular muscle injuries is one, if you can load and load early, relative to biological healing time, I'm not saying sprint them on day two, but start loading, you can improve return to play times. There's some good research out there that has shown that if you can start loading 2 days post-injury as opposed to a week later, 9 days post-injury, so front-end your loading, it can get you back 3 weeks earlier. There's a number of different studies that have shown, building to higher loads in rehab can actually protect you against subsequent injury as well. So in general, I would say, you want to try and load. It's more the rate of loading. That's the thing you need to be mindful of.
Great. Again, Caroline, if you've got some follow-up questions to that, then feel free to do so. How do you mentioned pain there maybe as a measure of how much you can load them. Is that all we've got really? Is it dependent on how much pain they're in? Do you use a pain scale, or is there some other way of telling?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're actually working on something at the moment, specifically related to that. We've got a paper in review around how do you quantify local tissue loads. And the reality is it's pretty tough. Pain is probably one of the best measures we've got. External load or the actual work that you do is obviously a good one. But one of the other methods that we use for sport-specific capacity is the session RPE. Now, session RPE provides a global measure of internal load. It's the athlete's perception of effort, but we would argue that it's probably not specific enough or sensitive enough to detect local tissue loads. Now, whether we need to develop a tissue specific RPE to quantify the loading there, and you know, you ask a question, you modify the question to how hard was that on your Achilles, or how hard was that on your hamstring? At the moment, we don't, and this is where the field's at, that we just don't have the technology to capture a lot of tissue specific loading in the field. We can estimate, say, bone loads through inertial measurement sensors, but in terms of some of the other local tissue loads, it's very difficult to quantify. And that's the challenge we've got at the moment, is with pain plus an external load measure is probably the best we've got as a guide to progressing loads at the moment.
It makes me, it reminds me what you said earlier on, where you like the squeeze of the arm or the eyeball connection. Obviously, we know because of the kind of whole psychosocial factor of pain and everything, that whether the athlete manages more reps or not is going to be dependent on other factors apart from the tissue, local tissue. So I suppose if you're going to use pain, then that means, I mean, how aware are you of making sure that all the other factors like the yellow flags and things like that have been kind of dealt with before expecting the athlete to stop because it's actually the tissue which has reached capacity, as opposed to maybe the fear or the worry or something that's on their mind?
Yeah, well, look, fear of movement is one of the big ones early on. So, you know, that's definitely part of how we progress load. We've got limited research evidence on how we progress local tissue loads, or how we quantify local tissue loads, but we've got a heap of clinical experience, and we have got the athlete in front of us. So just relying on a research paper to progress the loads is probably not the best way to go. You know, particularly if the research is incomplete. So, because if that was the case, we wouldn't do anything. So we've got the research, but then we've also got to rely on our clinical experience, and we've also got to have the athlete in front of us to help us make a decision. You know, that fear of movement is not necessarily an issue with the tissue. It's you know, there's other things that we need to consider in there, and that psychosocial understanding of some of the psychosocial issues that are going on, and the athlete's beliefs around movement and load are pretty important, because it shapes the kind of treatment or type of management that we give that athlete.
I mean, you've worked with the elitist of the elitist in various sports, and we always presume maybe that the elites, rather than kind of having a worry or preoccupation they're going to do themselves harm, they've got the opposite, where they might be reporting, oh yeah, that's about a 2 out of 10 pain, but really they're putting up with 7 or 8 because they think unless they've got some pain, they're not going to get through it. Is that something that you have to consider, or is that a generalization? Or
I've been fortunate enough to work with some elite athletes, and some of them are very tough. Some of the things they do in competition, and then they come back into training, and you see what they can handle in training, and you're kind of amazed, you know, astounded that they can do the things they do in competition, because it's like two different people sometimes. Other times you can see why individuals are able to do the things they do in competition, because they just, when they train with just such intent. But equally, you know, even though there's elite level athletes that do some exceptional things, you know, some of the athletes that wouldn't be described as elite or professional, some of the things that they've been able to do and overcome in their lives and fight their way out of it are equally impressive, I think, sometimes. You know, and there's a heap of elite athletes who are very talented, or professional athletes who are very talented, who probably didn't achieve as much as they could have because they didn't have enough of that ability to push through some of that pain. And it's a hard one, because you know, pushing through that pain on a regular basis, I don't know how healthy that is. But you know, definitely in some sports, and certainly some of the sports that we play over here, there's a real toughness about them. Like it's no place for boys. You know, you've got to be physically and mentally tough to put your head where most people won't put their feet. So yeah, I take my hat off to those people who do it week in, week out. It takes a lot of courage.
We've got a question here, and it's something I was going to ask you about. Let me where it had gone. Yeah, so Timothy Grigg has said here, I love the term optimal loading, as it can be applied to all stages of rehab that's relevant to healing progression. Optimal load from acute to end stage rehab is obviously different, but means the same, if that makes sense. I was going to ask you, actually, because you refer to the difference between load monitoring and optimal loading. You make quite an important distinction between the two. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, if we let's take some extremes. You have someone who's monitoring load, but the athlete isn't doing anything. So this person is sitting in their office, sitting in front of their Excel sheet or their athlete monitoring system. They're watching that screen like it's the last thing they're ever going to do. But nothing's happening because the athlete isn't training. But they're still monitoring it just in case something does happen. Now, that's one extreme. Now, the other extreme is you might have a strength coach, or a real gung-ho strength coach, who says, you know, to never get injured, all you need to do is lift more. If you lift more, you'll never get injured. Now, in general, I would agree that stronger athletes tend to be protected against injury and they tend to perform better. But just lifting more isn't optimal loading either. So when we load, when we lift, we need to monitor the response to that. And that's where the load monitoring comes in. Now, unless you make an adjustment, if the response is good, then you just go back and you load again. But if the response isn't good and you don't make an adjustment, then it's not optimal loading. You need to either increase or decrease the load, or give a little bit more recovery in between sessions, or if they haven't responded well, you might have to give some extra activation before the next session before you load again. It's when you combine the two, where you load, you monitor that load before deciding how and when to load again. That's when you get closer to optimal loading. Now, the reality, optimal loading it's a bit of a holy grail, because it's a moving target. Because at any point in time, we're trying to load slightly greater than our capacity to handle load, but our capacity at any point in time is dependent on our health. So the load I can handle today could change tomorrow, not because I've lost strength or aerobic fitness, simply because I've had a transient reduction in health, which therefore leads to a transient reduction in capacity. And that's what, and that health, those health factors are things like your stress, your sleep, nutrition, hydration, and, you know, it could be sickness as well. So there's a whole heap of things that can impact on your capacity to handle load from day to day.
Timothy, if you want to follow that up, then please do so. Becky Carroll's just mentioned, I don't know if you've read this, Tim, but Eddie Hall's autobiography is pretty interesting with regards to this topic. I'm sure he's got some very interesting anecdotes, Eddie Hall, a beast. Caroline McKendrick says, what do these special elite athletes have that others don't? Physical differences, mental differences, sports, hypnotherapy. Yeah, going back to what you're talking about, having worked with elites.
Oh, look, I mean, it's a good question, Caroline. I think in some cases it could be physical differences. In some cases it could be differences in technical or perceptual skill. The really good ones have got there's a certain mental resilience about them. And there's an interesting paper, you know, it's on talent identification, talent development, but you know, we put nowadays in elite sport, we put all the everything an athlete could want. We put these ideal conditions around them, so they have great facilities. We do all the warm-ups for them. We provide them food. They get massaged. They've got everything at their disposal. But this paper is called "Why Talent Needs Trauma," and it basically talks about how some of the best athletes, and I'm not talking just the ones who make it onto a national team, I'm talking about the very best of the best, have had to go through or overcome some sort of adversity in their life. And it could be maybe their parents have divorced, or maybe they've lost one of their parents growing up, or both their parents. It could be as simple as when they were younger, they got rejected from every representative team, but they fought their way through that and they came out the other side. And what this paper is suggesting is that maybe we need a little bit of trauma, a little bit of adversity, embrace that adversity, because if you can overcome that, you start to learn some strategies to overcoming those challenges when you have to face them later on in your career. And if you've gone through your entire playing career having a rails run and never having that much adversity, never having to overcome adversity, then you don't really have the coping strategies to deal with it when something goes against you later on in your career when you become an adult. So I think that's a I th you know I'm really fascinated by that part. That So, and we've all got stories like that. The things that you achieve, you, me, Matt, we achieve in our life, we can tie back to specific moments that happened in our lives. We probably don't know it at the time that they're critical moments, but they end up becoming pretty important moments that shape the way we problem solve, shape the way we go about our business. And I think that's a big thing with athletes.
Very interesting. Did you say that's a study that's being carried out at the moment, or?
No, it's a paper that's been out a while. It's
All right.
a review paper in sports medicine.
Okay, we'll look it
I
up
can
then.
send it through to you, Matt, and feel
Yeah,
free
great. We'll
to
just put it in the comments if
read
people are
it.
interested. I was going to ask. Oh yeah, so I wanted to make sure that we. I wanted to hear from you some of the myths or misconceptions. You see a lot of people are interested in load management, and they obviously they come to you for some of your courses to learn more. What are some of the, because it has become a bit of a buzzword, it's been around a while now. What are some of the myths and misconceptions or things that people are doing wrong then? I mean, they've been bracing load and they kind of think, right, I've got to get this person stronger. But what are some of the pitfalls or red herrings that in your experience therapists might fall for?
I think the biggest one is that load management means resting players more. Depending on in the States, for example, the NBA, load management is the buzz term in the NBA. But I actually think it's been given a bad rap. Maybe the media have picked up on it, or maybe some people have got a different idea of what load management means. But I think the media believe that load management is just resting players more. And I think the way they've explained it in the press is that it's almost like a term that sports medicine and performance staff have made up to stop coaches from coaching their players or playing their players, and it couldn't be further from the truth. Good load management is all about using well-established training principles, and the idea behind training is to have enough quantity and quality of training, good training, that allows you to handle the minutes that you need to play as part of your sport. Now, there may be occasions where you might have to reduce load a little bit, but the idea is that it's not about taking players out of training or taking players out of games. It's about putting the best program in place so that you can give that player to the coach more often, and that they've got them more often. And when they do have them, they're not only available, but they're ready to play. and they can execute your game style. That to me is what load management should be about. But I think there's a lot of people out there that misunderstand load management. They see it as resting players.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Do you guys in Australia, I mean, over in the UK, I'm not sure where it came from originally, but the whole acronym RICE, the idea of rest and change to police, did you get that? The idea was you put some optimal loading in there. Did that take off in Australia as well?
Yeah. I don't know if it's taken off so much. I'm sure it probably has, but I have seen the acronym. Yeah, it's a tough one because RICE has been around a long time. So
I wonder if that's part of the problem, because it's always rest first of all, but even like you've said, if someone comes in and they've had an injury yesterday, it's all about trying to get them to put some weight on that leg if they can, start optimally loading and stuff. But I wonder whether just getting rid of ice would help people to be less protective.
Yeah, but potentially. I mean, that may tie into it. You know, I think, you know, I've spoken to a lot of different people about this and you know, asked what is it that, you know, that creates that fear of loading. And, you know, a physical therapist told me once that it was, you know, because they know what can go wrong, there's, you know, maybe that's why they're more cautious. You know, at any point in time, the risk of injury is pretty low in any sport. So I kind of look at things a little bit more glass half full. I sort of go, well, look, how would you train this athlete if you weren't governed by fear of injury? And, you know, I think most people, when you say that, they go, well, look, I'd load them. I said, well, load them because if you load them, that's going to help protect against injury. Don't worry about things that may never happen. Don't give yourself an ulcer about something that may never happen. Just focus on what you can control, and what you can control is a good program. If you can build to higher loads, you develop physical qualities, and that leads to good performance. Focus on the performance outcome, and the other stuff will take care of itself.
Very good. We've got a question here, COVID related, from Gary or Jake. I'm not sure who's behind Sports Therapy Association tonight, but we've got a question here. Let's stick it up here so we can see on the screen. Do you anticipate COVID having any long-lasting problems for athletes? Australia is way ahead of UK in terms of scientific research and sport, as well as having dealt better with COVID. Bit of a political dig there. So it's gone up. So I'm interested in what if you and Australia are seeing in athletes that may have tested positive.
I don't have too many athletes that have tested positive to it, to be honest. So there was one of my water polo players who was in the States at the time, and he caught COVID, and it knocked him about a bit. But by the time we spoke to him, he was kind of recovered from it. But he did say, look, it's not something that you want to get if you can avoid it. In terms of long-lasting effects of COVID, well, I'd be speculating in terms of what that'll be. I don't think anyone really knows for sure. In terms of the short-term effects, it'll be like any detraining effect. So if you're stop training for a while, if you don't use it, you'll lose it. And it'll be the same thing with COVID. So, but what you're also recovering from is, you know, quite a significant illness. So, you know, you're going to have to take your time getting someone out of that state. You know, there could be a reduction in aerobic capacity. Definitely there'll be a reduction in strength if they've been laid up for a while. So reassessing that capacity to handle load and before loading again is probably going to be key. You know, and while you're loading the athlete, and then after those sessions, just checking in on the response to load is pretty important as well. Are they tolerating the load you're giving them? Are they breathing okay? Are they feeling okay? And then are they recovering well after the session? I think is probably a good tip to manage your way out of it.
Cool. Lisa's got a question here. She seems to think there's something apart from loading that an injured athlete needs. But she says, what other types of interventions alongside loading would you recommend following something like an acute lateral ankle sprain? Or is it all loading? Are you into other things for either
Well, look, yeah, I mean, I work with physical therapists, Lisa, so they would be kind of prescribing the treatments here. Depending on the severity of the ankle sprain, you know, we will have people go into a boot for a while, one of those moon boots, and you know, they'll be getting regular physical therapy. You know, in terms of, they will be doing some passive therapy. Now, the passive therapy may not result in you know, terrific long term outcomes, but the idea behind the passive therapy is to get that athlete in a place where we can use some active loading. So, you know, if you ask me, do we use passive therapies? So I would say absolutely we use passive therapies. But we also use it with the view of an understanding of why we're using it. We're using it so that we can, it's either to make the athlete, to help the athlete feel a little bit better, or to gain a bit of trust with the athlete. It could be to get a bit of blood flow through the injured tissue, whatever the reason is. But then we're trying to progress that from the passive therapy into the active loading.
It's interesting, again, for somebody who's worked with elite athletes, I tend to see or get the impression that elite athletes more than anybody kind of believe and that their physical therapist or massage therapist is actually breaking down knots and adhesions, and they expect a bit of pain, they like it. I mean, there's research which has shown that in fact a bit of pain during therapy might improve the endurance of that person when it comes to the sport. But have you seen that with elites? Do they kind of, a lot of them, they keep these beliefs going that they need to be pummeled to death, otherwise they're not going to get better or perform well?
Yeah, look, I don't think I've ever really discussed how an athlete feels when they're getting some soft tissue work done. But if you, let's put me in the position of the athlete, because you know, I've convinced myself that I'm an athlete and who's just been paid by their job to train. So yeah, look, if I'm going for a massage, then in general, I don't know if it's pain, but I want a deep massage. I want to feel like something's being done there. Now you'll probably know better than I will about the fine line between that therapy being a positive and a negative, having a positive and a negative effect. So I assume it's a type of load that we're putting through the body. Now, massage in itself is you know, probably more viewed as a recovery aid than what we'd say as extra training load. But I wonder if we put so much pressure through an athlete, through their tissues when we're massaging them, does that then become a positive training load? So it's actually adding to the training load rather than, you know, almost subtracting from it to make you feel better. It's actually making you feel worse. I mean, I don't know for certain. What do you reckon? Do you think that's a possibility?
Oh, you can't ask me. No, you can't do that.
That's not the rules.
That's interesting. I mean, it depends. I mean, there is examples of where massage can, and it often does make people worse the next day because you've gone in too high. In fact, a lot of massage therapists are still told on schools in the UK, don't forget to warn your patient, it might hurt the next day, but that's normal. It's to be expected. Whereas I will teach my therapist that it shouldn't really hurt the next day. That means you've done too much. It means that the body, the nervous system in particular, is kind of still feeling threatened and outputting more pain and stuff. But again, it depends. At the end of the day, it depends on the person in front of you. And we've had athletes over here, I don't know if it's a UK thing, but for example, Paula Radcliffe was famous, and her coach, who was a very respected coach who followed her for kind of over an 8 or 9 year period, always kind of remarked that he's never known an athlete internationally who wanted to endure as much pain as Paula Radcliffe did. I mean, he really pummeled her until she was crying and screamed because she just wanted more and more. And that, he feels, gave her the edge. She needed to feel that and break that barrier. I think Alex Hutchins, has in his book Endure. I don't know if you've read, but he's kind of talked upon that as well, about the whole idea of enduring during your treatments might increase that endurance for when you are trying to, you know, keep going. But I don't know. I think it's the divide between an athlete and just a person who comes in pain, and you're just giving their nervous system even more reason to be in pain by hurting them. So who knows?
Michael, I think, you know, endurance athletes are special in that respect. You know, if you're an endurance athlete, you've got to be able to put yourself down in a bit of a pit. Be prepared to hold yourself down in that pit for a long, long time, hopefully longer than someone else, and then you've got to back yourself to fight your way out of it. And that's what makes these endurance athletes so special, because, you know, I still talk to my dad about it a lot, because we did a lot of running together, and he always tells me how he did a lot of miles when he was mile races. And he said, didn't matter what race, that first lap, he said, he was thinking to myself, I got no chance of getting through four of these. And it's exactly how you feel when the race first starts, your hammers and tongs, and you just, you're struggling. And then somehow you get into a rhythm, and you manage to find a kick at the end and whatever else. But that first lap, you're thinking, what have I got myself in for here?
We've got a question here, or rather a comment, going back to our vice and optimal loading stuff from M. Turner, which is quite a nice comment. Let's read it out. M. Turner says, I've been using Police. Oh, have you seen Peace and Love as well? Have you seen that? Has that made its way over to you?
Yeah, I have.
I can't work on that.
I haven't got my head around that one yet.
I think Blaise Dubois, and I think the running clinic have been promoting it a lot. It's just too long for me. But yeah, I've seen that as well. I couldn't tell you what it stands for. Yeah, Peace and Love, Pitch Side. Emma says she's been using for a while. It goes completely against what the previous person did. I therefore have a reputation for being a lazy ball breaker, because I get them up and moving where possible before sticking any ice on it. Yeah, I mean, I think if you do, yeah, that's it's actually a thing, isn't it? If you're doing something different with an athlete or a patient, what they're used to, then you've got to kind of blend that in gradually. You can't just suddenly say what the person was doing before doesn't make sense. You've got to give them a little bit what they expect, haven't you, and then kind of educate them a little bit. Yeah, the magic sponge, they're going, where's my sponge? Yeah, I suppose you're supposed to put some magic sponge on me. No, good on you. Yeah. And that's the difference you see between a sports therapist and a physio there in a nutshell. Thanks, Emma. That's good work. Well done. Keep it going. So let's talk about courses and online things that you've got going on. You've just finished a course, haven't you? Your Europe course. How did that go? That was over the weekend.
Yeah, it was really good. Thanks, Matt. It was, you know, we always have such great discussion and interaction with people. People come with their specific programs, their specific challenges. So, you know, it becomes quite a unique course. So, you know, I have a map of the kind of content that I'd like to get through. But you know, it's kind of like taking a trip on a highway and then going off road for a little bit and following where that person wants to take it, try and discuss their programs, give them some answers around their programs. So I really enjoyed it, and they came from all over the world, you know, from New Zealand right through to the States and Europe and Scandinavia. So it was and Australia. So it was a lot of fun.
And what sort of clinicians are we talking about? Was it a mixture, or we're talking about?
We had physical therapists, sports therapists, athletic trainers, chiropractors, strength and conditioning coaches, and also we had a head coach come along this one, which was really, really cool. You know, she wanted to learn about managing her staff better, her performance and medicine staff, and she wanted to be able to have contribute to the conversation in an informed way. So look, when we have coaches along, they contribute so much. I've had previous sessions where coaches have led, you know, we do little practical parts, and they've led the early stage rehab program. You know, which is just fantastic that they feel confident enough to get up in front of people who are you know probably have more expertise in that area and then lead it. It was terrific. You know, those kind of things are nice little wins when you see coaches doing that kind of thing, and people kind of stretching themselves out of their comfort zone. But you can see they've actually, it's been tough for them, but they've really embraced and really enjoyed the challenge of that. So yeah, I enjoy that part of it.
That's great. And I often ask this to everybody who's kind of running courses: what are some of the eureka moments that you see from people who are doing your course, where their eyes just gone, oh my god, I've never thought of it that way, or kind of myths which they have a little bit busted? What are some of the typical ones which you see?
Well, one of the things I do is I get three groups to put together a return to play program, and there are three different groups working on different areas of the return to play program, and I give them a heap of instructions, but then I say, and the only rule is you're not allowed to speak among the groups, and they're trying to work out. They can work out their little part of the program. They're trying to work out why it's so hard, you know, and they're just, I can't work it out. I can't work out where I need to finish. And I'm going, well, why is that? And then they go, geez, it'd be so much easier if I was able to talk to this person in the next phase. So the idea being that by emphasizing that you're not allowed to talk, it emphasizes how important that is. And that you actually need good communication from your physical therapist early in rehab, right through to your coaches at return to performance for it to work. I really believe that part of the reason rehab falls down, it falls down somewhere in the process. It could be that the athlete isn't training hard enough early in rehab, or it could be that they're training too hard later. But either way, they're probably both right, because the communication has fallen down. So when they recognize that, they go, oh, of course, you know, like it would be so much easier. Things would work so much better if we just talked. So those kind of things are kind of moments that we know are there. We know it's important to do it, but we just sometimes, when the pressure's on, when the heat's on, we go back to what we know best. We just go back into our shell a little bit.
Brilliant. And who do you think, I mean, everyone obviously who goes into your course is going to benefit, but if you were trying to find somebody who could really would be at the right stage in their career to go onto one of your courses, what would be the kind of things which they're trying to improve or take away from it?
Oh, look, I think it's the kind of course where if you're a physical therapist who spends a lot of time in that early stage rehab area, then what you will learn about, I think one of the biggest things you'll learn is what happens at the other end. So, you know, what are you actually bringing that athlete back to do? And then if you've got an understanding of that, then that is so informative to the kind of load you provide early in rehab. And from a strength and conditioning viewpoint, you know your world in terms of strength and conditioning and exposing the athletes to the demands of competition. But what it kind of promotes is the ability to look back and say, okay, well, this is the kind of loading that's being done early in rehab. Okay, I need to consider that when I expose my athletes to these tough demands, because if they haven't done that lead-in work, how are they going to be ready for what I'm about to throw at them? So it's, I think a big thing is the appreciation of as much about loading and different ways to achieve that and do it in an individual way. It's just an understanding and appreciation of different professions as well. So I think that it sort of goes across a few professions in that way.
Fantastic. And do you, I mean, some people are fearful of going on courses because they think it's going to be too much for them. Or is there kind of, who do you think, what would people need to have before going onto your course? Do you kind of like check out who's coming on or set like a qualification or a level of understanding before they come on? Or
Well, look, it's based on It's based firstly on research evidence, right? So the idea is to take the latest research evidence on loading. But one of the things I try and do is present it in a user-friendly way. So, you know, if you've, you know what it's like reading research papers, they're pretty hard to read. You know, I often joke that I don't read any of my papers again unless I'm having trouble sleeping at night, because, you know, they're just, they're really sciencey. They're hard to get through. So, but I think there's a lot of good info in them. So what I try and do is take the information out of it and just present it in a way that, okay, well, this is what it means to your practice. So in terms of the qualifications, all you need to be able to do is accept the fact that I'm not going to tell you what to think, but I am going to try and encourage you how to think. So I'm going to try and draw out of you what you've already got in you. And so if you come with that kind of mindset, that you want to improve your clinical reasoning skills, you want to challenge your beliefs around a certain topic, then you'll get a lot out of the course. So, you know, if you were a physical therapist, sports therapist, strength and conditioning coach, anyone working in the health professions who has to try and get an athlete out of rehab or keep them out of rehab, keep them at performing at high levels, would probably enjoy the course, because it's not just research. There's a, you know, there's a few different ways of presenting that. Heaps of practical things in there as well that sort of keep you moving the whole time.
And I think, I mean, I'm just going to put your website full screen now for people wondering where you've gone. There you go. There's lots of information on your website, testimonials and things that people can find out about. And you've also got videos and details of online stuff people can do. And also some great blogs as well and up-to-date things going on. What have you got coming up for people who are listening to the podcast or watching on YouTube or Facebook? What have you got coming up over this year? They've missed out the Europe one. Have you got anything else planned? Or
yeah, look, I think this new course, the new online course, is something that we put a lot of time into that. I didn't realize how much time it was going to take, but the end product, you know, I'm really, really happy with. There's so, you know, we'll keep getting that out to teams and individuals.
Something where they do it themselves? So the idea is you work through it yourself.
Yeah, it's an on-demand course. So the live online course is one that we do, and it's interactive. So that was one on the weekend. But the on-demand course is the one that's the online certificate course. So it's got something like 15 hours of content and over 10 hours of practical skills videos and hands-on activities. So you can do it at your own pace. You can go back and watch it anytime. There's quizzes, there's the activities that you can do to test your understanding. So there's a whole heap of different ways to learn. So and a whole heap of different examples in there. We're just trying to keep up with the people enrolled in it at the moment. There's a lot of people doing it at the moment, which is great. And now what we're finding too is a lot of different sporting teams are putting their staff through it, so that everyone in the organisation is speaking a similar language. They don't have to think the same way. You know that we still want diversity in the group, but when everyone's talking about load, they're all talking about the same thing. So you know, as soon as travel gets up and running again, I'll keep getting around to teams and keep getting around to different places. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to getting back to the UK and the States and getting out and seeing people again. That's probably been the challenge being locked down is, it's kind of like a marathon with no finish line at the moment. So we've just got to keep our head down, put one foot in front of the other and you know, we'll come through the other side and we'll be stronger as a result of it, but we just got to be patient. It'll pass eventually.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And yeah, hopefully we will come out stronger. We're already seeing ways which certain things are improving. I think we said off air, wasn't we? This time last year, you were actually in Birmingham, weren't you, with Mike Grice? Was it around now?
That's right. It was, I think it was early March.
Yeah.
It was, it was the first place we visited, and then we went to a number of different countries, Germany and Switzerland and Belgium and Netherlands, and everywhere we went, it felt like we were being chased by COVID. The borders would close behind us. It was quite a trip.
Terrible. But we will get through. So Sports Therapy Association, I think it's Jake tonight, can't remember, or Gary. I'd highly recommend Tim's course. It's really practical, can easily be translated to the therapy world. So yeah, we're talking about athletes, but I guess the principles are still the same for people who just want to get back to functional fitness, and recreational athletes. You don't have to be looking after elite athletes to benefit from the course. Well, look at it, 9:12 already. That's gone over time. Well, we should have expected it. With a man of this level, and you yourself, you're still, I've seen you still training very hard, or the photos look like, unless you've just done one of those Mike James kind of spray on the sweat and then tell someone to take a photo, but you seem to be out there training very hard.
I'm just really good with Photoshop. I just grab really fit looking bodies and put my head on them. For me it's as much about the mental as it is the physical. It's probably more about the mental. I get a lot of mental benefits from training, but also if I'm going to stand up in front of a group of people and say consistent training is a good thing, it's a good thing to train hard, then I want to believe it. So you know, every day it's like a case study, N of one, and it's kind of like a proof of concept for me. I know it's just a story. It's not actually evidence as such, but for me it's a critical part, a really important part of how I go about my day. If I don't train on a regular basis, then I don't feel as good. So it's pretty important for me.
Great, good answer. Right, people, thank you so much, Tim, for joining us. If people want to contact you, obviously, if they want to find out more information than the website, let me just bring it up again. Gabbit, 2 B's and 2 T's performance. Then that is the website. It's .com. Loads of information on there. And if people want to contact you, is it best going through the website, or are you on a particular form of social media more than others, or?
I am on social media, but probably the best thing to do is to come through the website, because then you know that I'm going to see it. Sometimes I see those messages and then I get distracted, and then I feel ignorant when I only get back to them later after forgetting about them. So yeah, come through the website.
Brilliant. Okay, and we're going to put a few of the links which you mentioned, like to the paper, where the elites get their strength from. We'll put these in the links, and we'll use this, as always, the comment section here to update you. So if you've got any more questions, then do feel free to put them in there. If you're listening to the podcast or watching YouTube, then feel free to send questions in or put them on the YouTube channel, and we will get back to you. Tim, thanks so much for your time. I've taken up a quarter of an hour more than I said I would, so sorry about that.
My pleasure, Matt. Thanks for having me on. It's been a good chat, and thanks everyone for dropping in for the hour. I appreciate your questions and taking the time to have a chat. Hope you're all well over there.
That's a shame it's like 9:15 in the UK, because you've inspired me now and made me feel probably a bit guilty that I should be going out for a run or something. But it's not. It's 9:15 now. So it's time for us to get our cocoa and slippers on. But mate, you have a great day. I hope that it doesn't rain too much and that you enjoy yourself.
Yeah, thanks, mate. You too.
Right, people, we'll see you next Tuesday. Watch out on social media to see who the guest is. And as always, this will be available as a podcast in a few days if you need a re-listen. And if you've already heard it and you like it, then let other people know. We'll see you next week. Thanks, Tim.
You're listening to the Sports Therapy Association podcast. Let's talk about it.